Recorded history, man has labored to improve the material well-being of himself and his loved ones, to secure more food, better shelter, and finally, additional conveniences. In America, under a written constitution that established a limited form of government, man made great leaps forward in a relatively short period of time. Here, where man was really free for the first time, his unrestrained ingenuity increased productivity enormously to achieve an abundance of material blessings only dreamed of in ancient times. The proverbial horn of plenty has truly overflowed. The variety and volume of material goods available today would have staggered the senses of history's mightiest and richest kings. Despite their power and riches, they had no access to the abundance available to the average American like Mr. and Mrs. Jones. And Mr. and Mrs. Jones strolled through their material wonderland, taking it all for granted, showing concern only when something distracts them. Mrs. Jones picks up a loaf of bread and is about to put it in her basket when she notices the price, 42 cents. She stops, thinks back to last week when she shopped, and recalls that the same loaf of bread was 39 cents. She's upset, of course, and complains to Mr. Jones that everything seems to be going up. They're both quick to blame this particular price increase on the store, the baker, and, of course, the wheat grower. Unfortunately, the Joneses have completely overlooked the real culprit in creating what they think of as inflation. Most people think that inflation is the rising price level of goods and services, but this is not strictly so. For the rising prices are a result of inflation, not inflation itself. Inflation is defined as an increase in the volume of money and credit relative to available goods, resulting in a substantial and continuing rise in the general price level. There's nothing deep or hard to grasp about inflation. When the amount of money and credit in circulation increases at the same rate as productivity increases, the amount of goods available, prices of the available goods remain generally stable. But should the amount of money and credit in circulation increase without a corresponding increase in the amount of available goods, prices of available goods will be forced upward by the inflated volume of money and credit. In an exchange economy such as the United States, people exchange their labor or goods and services for the thing called money, which they then use to purchase the goods and services they desire. If the items used as money have no actual value, nor are they representative of and redeemable in something that does have actual value, the money itself cannot be considered real wealth. Unvalued money is fiat money, and people accept it for their goods and services, and hope that they will be able to exchange the fiat money for the goods and services of others. Such an arrangement can be quite convenient, but is also subject to an obvious weakness. The items actually used as money do not come into existence automatically. They are created by someone out of something. Of the many items that have been used as money, the most successful has been gold, which possesses certain special qualities. Gold has value in itself, for as a commodity it has numerous uses. As a medium of exchange, gold was and still is highly dependable. For although the supply can be increased, the increase is limited by how rapidly it can be located, mined, and processed. Unfortunately, gold's scarcity, an asset that makes it desirable as a medium of exchange, can also present a serious problem. As a population grows and the amount of goods available increases, what happens to the need for money in circulation? A simple illustration answers the question. Two people, using money to exchange their goods and services to each other, find it desirable to have 6 pieces of money available to efficiently carry on the exchange process. If a third person joins the group and adds to the supply of goods and services available, a larger total number of pieces of money will be necessary if the exchange process is to function as efficiently as when there were only 2 people. When gold is the only medium of exchange in use, unless the supply increases as rapidly as the population and the amount of goods and services available, the exchange process becomes restricted. Gold is somewhat limited in its ability to meet every legitimate need for an increase in the amount of money in circulation. The use of printed paper money as a medium of exchange goes back in history many centuries and appears to have begun in China. Marco Polo returned from China with a tale of how the Emperor Kublai Khan had seized all the gold in his domain and then issued pieces of paper with a value written on them, which the people had to accept at face value. This scheme soon found favor in other parts of the world. Governments discovered they could obtain money by simply printing paper, and they did so. The results of fiat money have always been disastrous for the people who actually created the goods and services that existed. The experience of the people of Germany following World War I is a graphic example. In 1922, the people of Germany were suffering through severe shortages of material goods and rapidly rising prices. While their political leaders were increasing government spending and simply issuing unbacked paper money to pay the bills. This irresponsible inflation of the money supply, which had already driven the value of the German mark down to 162 to 1 U.S. dollar from the pre-1914 level of 4.2 to 1 U.S. dollar, rapidly reached incredible proportions. The German mark, from the level of 162 to 1 U.S. dollar in early 1922, fell to over 4 trillion marks to 1 U.S. dollar on November 20th, 1923. In Germany, million, billion, and finally trillion mark notes became commonplace but worthless. The postage to send a local letter was 100 billion marks, and a sack of paper money brought only a single loaf of bread. Those on fixed incomes and the thrifty, responsible people who had savings, insurance policies, and other investments lost everything they had worked a lifetime for. They were the victims of their own government's manipulation of the money supply. Attempts by governments to manipulate the amount of money in circulation have always been disastrous. When a government has the power to create money, those in power simply create new money whenever they want more money to spend. History clearly shows that governments have been the most consistently guilty party in the inflation of the money supply. During the American Revolution, paper money was issued by the Continental Congress to pay the cost of the war. The paper money was unbacked and soon became almost worthless as an acceptable medium of exchange. This gave birth to the phrase, not worth a continental. Just a few years later, the drafters of the United States Constitution, drawing from the lessons that history offered, especially the disastrous experience of the previous decade, gave only limited monetary power to the new government. Article 1, Section 8 provides, "The Congress shall have power to coin money and regulate the value thereof." This granted to government the power to create money in a very restricted manner, the coining of money. The drafters of the Constitution were men of wisdom and foresight. They knew that even though the government they were creating was designed to serve the people rather than rule them, the powers it would have must, through necessity, be placed at the disposal of those who are elected or appointed to high office. So they proceeded on a basis so clearly stated by Thomas Jefferson. "In question of power, let no more be heard of confidence in man, but bind him down from mischief by the chains of the Constitution." In monetary matters, that is exactly what the Constitution does. To coin money was the only power to create money granted to the government, and coining money means just that and nothing more. Since the United States government has only the legitimate power to coin money, just who has the right to print paper money? The answer is simple. The Declaration of Independence declared that governments have no legitimate powers except those granted to them by the people. This principle of consent of the governed is the basis upon which the United States government was established. The powers granted to the United States government in the Constitution do not include the power to print paper money. And in no state constitution have the people of any state given that power to their state government. So as incredible as it may sound, the people have obviously reserved to themselves the right to issue mediums of exchange in any form other than coins. By the way, the viewer, before reacting to this startling but undeniable truth by rushing out to purchase a printing press, paper, and ink, should note that a natural barrier exists that makes it impractical for everyone to create their own medium of exchange. Mr. Jones and anyone else has the right to print their own medium of exchange, but they have no power to compel anyone to accept it as payment of debts or in exchange for goods and services. Unless a paper currency has been proclaimed legal tender by government in which case it must be accepted by the people, it will be accepted only by those who feel it is a valid and redeemable claim against the assets of the issuer. That the Constitution had not granted the United States government the power to issue paper currency was recognized and accepted even by government officials themselves until the Civil War. During 1862 and 1863, United States notes, popularly known as greenbacks, in the amount of $450 million, were ordered to be printed by Congress. Without any legitimate power to do so, they printed paper and magically created money. This supply of $450 million of instant money helped the government to pay its bills. But for the people who received the greenbacks, they were no bargain. The purchasing power of greenbacks fluctuated, generally downward. During the summer of 1864, goods that could be purchased for a $20 gold piece cost $50 in greenbacks. The issuance of gold certificates and later silver certificates was the next act of monetary sleight of hand by those in government. The premise and argument offered was quite simple. The government has the power to coin money, to mint silver and gold into coins that may be put into circulation, granted in Article 1, Section 8. Since coins are heavy and burdensome, the people will find it more convenient and it will be less expensive if the government issues paper substitutes. Of course, the amount of paper substitutes issued by the government would not exceed the amount of coins that could be minted from the gold and silver actually held by the government. This change in concept, although clearly a perversion of the monetary powers granted to government, left the government with still only very restricted powers to create money. The next important step of monetary manipulation occurred in 1913. President Woodrow Wilson, on December 23, 1913, signed the Federal Reserve Act. This initiated the creation of the Federal Reserve System, which was to provide a panacea long sought by politicians and economists, a controlled expansion of the money supply. The country was divided into 12 geographic districts, with each district to have one Federal Reserve Bank. The act required that all nationally chartered banks contribute a percentage of their assets to the Reserve Bank in their district. Capital stock in each Federal Reserve Bank was issued to the member banks for their contributions. This was stock in name only, for it could not be sold or transferred and did not entitle the member banks to actually control the Federal Reserve Banks. The government-established reserve banks were to operate within government-established limits that could be changed at any time by the government and were subject to rules and regulations issued by what is now known as the Board of Governors. 7 political appointees chosen by the president with the consent of the Senate. Each of the 12 Federal Reserve Banks was to be able to issue Federal Reserve notes, which would be claims against the Reserve Bank's assets. The government proclaimed that the notes would be legal tender, which must be accepted as lawful money, and that they would also be an obligation of the United States. The notes themselves could be printed for the Reserve Banks only by the U.S. Treasury Department, and the number to be printed was limited to an amount not to exceed certain assets the Reserve Banks would deposit as acceptable collateral. The Reserve Banks dealt primarily with member banks and could actually increase the volume of money in circulation by investing in certain commercial credit transactions defined as notes, drafts, and bills of exchange issued or drawn for agricultural, industrial, or commercial purposes that matured within 90 days. Investing in these short-term goods-producing transactions was to result in an increase in the amount of goods available and also increase the amount of money in circulation and new credit available to balance the situation. How beneficial or harmful this limited amount of monetary manipulation could have been is debatable, but not really important, for changes began taking place almost at once. The Federal Reserve Banks opened for business in 1914, and 2 years later, September 7, 1916, a significant new means of monetary manipulation was granted by the government to this government-created agency. The Reserve Banks could now loan money directly to member banks on the basis of their promissory notes secured by certain commercial credit, which included bonds or notes of the United States. To whom this new power was important became apparent almost immediately. World War I was already sweeping across Europe, and soon American fighting men were involved. When America entered the war, government spending took a gigantic jump upward. Other than coining money, the government has only two legitimate ways of obtaining money to pay its bills. One, taxes. And two, borrowing against the credit of the United States. Higher taxes are never popular with the citizens, so politicians have usually found borrowing, spend now, pay later, to be far more politically expedient. The government debt, which had been $1.2 billion on June 30, 1916, ballooned to $25.5 billion in just 3 years. The government had borrowed over $24 billion from somewhere during this three-year period. How they were able to do so is quite simple. Banks across the nation bought huge amounts of government bonds, for that was the patriotic thing to do. Government securities went to the bank, and the bank's money went to the government. The bank could replace its money by borrowing money from the Federal Reserve Bank on the basis of its promissory note secured by the government bonds. The Federal Reserve Bank could replace its money by ordering new Federal Reserve notes from the government, with the government bond secured promissory note of the local bank deposited as collateral. The government now actually had newly created money, which it put into circulation by paying its bills. The government could now spend more money because the increased supply of money generated an even greater amount of available credit, and the people could now be sold even more government bonds. This procedure had just one restraining factor. New money could be created only temporarily, for only short-term government securities could be used as security for the bank promissory notes that were used by the reserve banks as collateral for new Federal Reserve notes. Shortly after the war, America entered the era of the Roaring Twenties. People were enjoying the good life materially. Business was booming, and even government was prospering as revenues from taxes exceeded spending year after year. The national debt, which had been $25.5 billion in 1919, was being paid off, and by 1930 had been reduced to just over $16 billion. The crash came in October 1929. And an economic depression almost paralyzed the nation. For most Americans, it was a bleak time. They tightened their belts and tried to provide for their loved ones as best they could. Government income from taxes decreased, but the politicians increased rather than reduced government spending and fell back on borrowing the money to pay the bills. But the overspending was somewhat handicapped, for the people lacked the money and credit to purchase very many government bonds and notes. On February 27, 1932, the Glass-Steagall Act became law and declared that any government security or obligation purchased by the Federal Reserve banks would be acceptable to the government as collateral for new Federal Reserve notes to be printed for the Reserve banks. Politicians could now issue and sell an unlimited amount of bonds and notes to obtain the money to pay for their spending programs. Government overspending could now be changed into new money permanently in circulation. And this is what began happening. During the 4 months immediately following passage of the Glass-Steagall Act, enough government security to increase the government debt by $1.3 billion. This had been possible because during that same period, the government-established Federal Reserve banks bought enough government securities to increase their holdings by over $1 billion. Just one small stumbling block remained. Americans could still hold gold for monetary purposes. This limited the issuance of paper money somewhat, for the people could always simply return the Federal Reserve notes to the U.S. Treasury and demand that they be redeemed in gold. During the early days of Roosevelt's first administration, the American people were stripped of the privilege of possessing gold for monetary purposes, and this action successfully removed the last stumbling block. Between June 30, 1932 and June 30, 1969, the government-established Federal Reserve banks increased their holdings of government securities by more than $52.3 billion. These new assets served as the collateral for the additional $44.3 billion in Federal Reserve notes the government printed for the Federal Reserve banks. During this same 37-year period, the supply of actual money in circulation was inflated from $5.7 billion to almost $51 billion. This constant inflation of the amount of money in circulation increased the amount of available credit to gigantic proportions, which enabled the politicians to float enough government securities to finance the national debt from $19.5 billion in 1932 to an incredible $353.7 billion on June 30th, 1969. $353.7 billion is almost too large to comprehend. So let's look at it another way. Every man, woman, and child in the United States owes $1,800 in addition to their current taxes. In the case of Mr. Jones, with a wife and three children, that means his share of the national debt is $9,000. The United States government securities held by the Federal Reserve banks, which totaled $57.8 billion on December 3, 1969, earn interest and provide the bulk of Reserve Bank earnings. From its beginning in 1914 to the end of 1968, the Federal Reserve banks showed a profit after operating expenses of $18,228,468,126. A look at just where this vast amount of profit ended up is very revealing. The Federal Reserve Act required that privately owned banks invest their money in stock in the reserve banks, and provided that the member banks were to receive a dividend of 6% annually on their investment. Member bank dividends on their investment has accounted for just 4 cents of each dollar in profit accumulated by the Federal Reserve banks through 1968. Another 4 cents from each dollar in profit has been paid into a surplus fund. The remaining 92 cents of every dollar profit of the Federal Reserve banks, a total of $16,742,166,875, has gone to the United States Treasury. The Federal Reserve banks were created through government action. They are controlled by political appointees of the government, and the overwhelming portion of their profits go back to the government. To contend that they are privately owned and controlled is to deny reality. The Federal Reserve banking system is a quasi-governmental agency created by politicians who sought a means to escape the chains of the Constitution, which had given the government the power to only coin money. The constantly rising prices of the goods available is the result of their success in creating a means to deliberately inflate the money supply. The purchasing power of the dollar has shrunk by an incredible amount. The dollar of today is worth only 38 cents compared to the dollar of 1939. Mr. Jones must earn over $10,000 annually today to provide for his family, as well as his counterpart of 1939, who earned $3,800. Today, everyone notices that prices are climbing upward at an alarming rate. Unfortunately, due to their lack of knowledge in economics, they do not realize that the politically manipulated inflation of the money supply is the principal cause of the rising prices. Demands that the government step in and enforce strict control of prices grows louder almost daily. Many confused people echo the cry and thus find themselves supporting an incredible paradox. The politicians are being turned to and asked to save the people from the runaway prices, which are a direct result of the politicians' deliberate inflation of the money supply. A suspicious-minded person might wonder if the politicians planned this result from the beginning. Questions about the motives of those who created the Federal Reserve System are difficult to answer. But there is considerable evidence to indicate that some of the advocates saw it as a means to put the monetary system in the United States under political control. This book, Philip Drew, Administrator, The Story of Tomorrow, first appeared in 1912, the year before the Federal Reserve Act was passed. The author, who was anonymous at the time, told how his hero, Philip Drew, by cleverly exploiting turmoil in America, had seized control of the government. Philip Drew was portrayed as pure of heart, all-knowing, and so completely unselfish that as a dictator he was actually a blessing for the people. He cleansed America of all its so-called ills and inequities, rode off into the sunset, and the people lived happily ever after. The book obviously reflected the political philosophy and ambitions of its author. Years later, it was revealed that the author of Philip Drew, Administrator, was Colonel E. Mandel House. Colonel House was a powerful political manipulator who never sought nor held any public office during his long career. However, House was the closest confidant and the most trusted and listened to advisor of Woodrow Wilson before and during Wilson's presidency. His influence over President Wilson has been described as almost hypnotic. These now rare volumes, The Intimate Papers of Colonel House, were published in 1926 and shed light for the first time on the vital role that House had played in the creation of the Federal Reserve System. These papers revealed that even before Wilson's inauguration as president in March 1913, House was holding meetings with those in the Congress who were later to introduce the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Later, although Wilson was the president, Colonel House assured Carter Glass, the chief congressional sponsor of the bill, that he, House, would have the president bring pressure to bear if that was necessary to get the bill passed. House has been described as the unseen guardian angel of the bill, a title he certainly earned. The Federal Reserve Act gave President Wilson the power to appoint the members of the Board of Governors who would control the reserve banks. But it was Colonel House who interviewed those who were being considered for these vitally important positions, and those eventually chosen by Wilson were the ones recommended by House. Colonel E. Mandel House, a political manipulator who believed that a benevolent dictatorship was actually desirable, appears to have been the key person in the creation and launching of the Federal Reserve Banking System, the instrument that has enabled the politicians to generate the endless supply of fiat money that has driven the American dollar to the brink of destruction. It would be convenient to place all the blame for the disastrous inflation of the money on the houses and misguided or unprincipled politicians. But a major share of the responsibility for the flood of fiat money falls on that growing number of Americans who greedily clamor for all manner of special subsidies from government and elect to office those who promise to continue and even increase the handouts. Freedom in America has been crumbling for decades, and it will continue to crumble until the American people are ready to accept and fulfill the responsibilities that go hand in hand with freedom. The United States government has a legitimate role to play in monetary matters. The path to restore that constitutionally defined role will be difficult and perilous. But if this truly gigantic task can be achieved, the people will once again control the fruits of their labor. Time is running out. If sound money is to be restored, responsible Americans must demand that the journey begin now.